From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Nguyen announcing show number 548, Thinking IT with guest Tim Warner. Recorded Tuesday, August 22nd, 2017. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. Back in the studio after a month of crazy travel, my guest is Tim Warner, a Microsoft MVP in the cloud and data center management area, and a full-time trainer with Pluralsight. Tim's worked in many varieties of IT roles since entering the field full-time in 1997. His current area of focus is Microsoft Azure, cross-platform PowerShell, and open-source technologies, especially and including Linux. And he lives in Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome back, sir.
Thanks so much, Richard. It's great to be with you again, and it was really nice meeting you in person at the IT Dev Intersections Conference several months ago.
That was in the spring show, wasn't it?
Wow, time flies.
Time does fly. And, I'm just doing entirely too many conferences these days. I got to go out and get out to Gene Kim's DevOps show in London shortly after that.
Wow.
It's fun traveling, but I'm starting to miss home a lot. It was just saying to you before we started recording, back in my studio, I like it here. I don't know why I leave so much. Except there's so many fun things going on out in the world today. It's really a riot. But yeah, what a great show that was in Orlando. Mm-hmm. We really had a good time there. I'm looking forward to getting back. I'm already starting to look at 2018.
That's good. Will it be in the same venue? You can't beat Disney World.
That Swan Dolphin setup is like literally you can take a boat into Disneyland. We are still negotiating hotels. It's the hardest part. You know, I worry about the content plan, but my partner does all the logistics side. And so the negotiation over the space is like one of the most difficult parts of the equation. When all I have to do is picture and figure out what texts are going to matter in 9 months. Easy.
Mm-hmm. Comparatively, yeah, I would agree.
I don't know. It's a relative thing. I know we could probably bet on the cloud. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm thinking. The cloud's going to continue to be important in this equation.
Yeah. Happy news for some, not so happy news for others, but it's pretty inevitable nowadays.
Yeah. Well, I think you don't have to move to the cloud, but I think you, as an IT person, have to have an answer to the question, where does the cloud fit in for us?
Yeah.
You know, I still am working with organizations that say, you know, we have a problem here and here. Like this, the way that we're working doesn't make sense. But it's been enough years now that I'm now working with companies that are looking at renewing their colo locations, looking at buying new hardware, stuff's aging out. And you've got to sit this math side by side, APEX versus CAPEX. Mm-hmm. It was easy to ignore the cloud when you had one-year-old machines in a colo on a three-year license. Now, all that stuff's come up, and you're going to the powers that be to say, hey, I need $500,000. And then you look at just how much Azure that buys and go, how do I justify this?
Yeah, no doubt. You know, I read this book. You might have read it too, Freakonomics.
Oh, absolutely.
By Stephen Levitt. That really was revolutionary in describing the world as flat thanks to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that fits in with cloud computing finger in glove. Like you said, the idea of paying large upfront costs to co-locate your data center elsewhere. I mean, nowadays, the paradigm shift is such that it's almost trivially easy to geo-distribute, geo-replicate your applications to get them geographically and physically as close to your users around the world, no matter where they are.
Yeah, true enough. I mean, we use CDNs and don't blink at that, but this is just taking that whole thing that much further. Stuff that, I mean, I did back in the early aughts in the 90s where we, you know, I was working with customers that had data centers on two continents and we talked about MPLS connections between them and just the sheer volume of money we spent to build out what was essentially a private cloud.
Yep. Over the past year, I've been doing quite a bit of consulting in this space. And boy, what a luxury it is to be able to work from home in my bathrobe like the Big Lebowski and designing these solutions and talking about geo-replicating a database throughout the world, and it's not that big of a deal. But, of course, I found that customers still are surprised. They're thinking, well, I thought this would be cheaper to do. This is actually going to be pretty expensive. Huh. And it's like, where did you get the idea? Do you think that cloud equals free?
Yeah.
I wish that were the case.
And that's clearly not true. And I mean, the point here is that it used to only be the largest customers that talked about geo-replicated data centers that were all too common number decisions, right? That was reality. Now that geo-replication is in a shopping list of options in your cloud provider, folks that would have never considered it before are trying it, and they aren't finding out it's pennies. It's dollars, but it's not millions of dollars.
That's right. In the big scheme of things, when you think of geo-distributing your application using co-located data centers or even content delivery networks, whatever, that stuff just adds up, like you said earlier, the capital expenditure as opposed to a recurring OPEX.
Right.
But, you know, there's always opportunities for saving those costs in the cloud. That, I think, is a skill unto itself. I think that might be a good market, actually, to help businesses trim their cloud spend as much as possible, because I don't know if you'd call the costs hidden so much, but they may not be entirely obvious. Like, for instance, in the Azure cloud, with a storage account, you're charged for your transactions as well as your data egress.
Right. And so, and how many people actually know what their data egress numbers are going to be?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, my concern with the cloud in general, and this is purely a perception thing, is it's when your cloud bill becomes like your cell phone bill, you don't know what's going to happen. You know, till the end of the month, you find out how much you spent.
Yeah.
And you're like, how did this happen? Like, what happened here? And that, I think that's deeply concerning to a lot of folks. They're just kind of freaked out by this surprise. You've got a magic bill that doesn't represent what will happen. It's what has happened. So there's only so much arguing that can go on. Mm. And odds are by the time you're reading it and trying to study it, you're well into the next month spending like that again.
Mm. Right. Yeah, and I guess I would address that still with skill building, that just speaking in terms of Amazon Web Services and Microsoft Azure, both of those companies have already been there, done that long ago. And they have, at least in Azure's case, their subscription tool. I mean, they show you exactly what you've spent. And also, using their Azure Advisor framework, they're able to give you cost-saving tips. So the tools are there for you. You just have to, A, know that they exist,
right.
B, know where to find them, and C, know how to understand or interpret the results.
Do you see it as in Microsoft's best interest to be good at reducing, at educating its customers about reducing their spend on Azure?
Yes, I do. I was meditating on this very subject last night, just comparing from a trend perspective, the trajectory of Amazon Web Services and Azure. And I give Microsoft huge props in how much emphasis they've put on helping the customers understand the platform. Of course, it's in their best interest business-wise to get customers and retain customers. And I think that just to look at their documentation, how they've expanded and broadened it and deepened it over the last year, they're doing great things there. They are investing heavily in education. In fact, a lot of my day job work at Pluralsight has been producing partnership content that Microsoft is hosting right on Azure.com.
Nice.
So it's definitely in their best interest to retain customers, and they already know, because they own the technology, that most customers are afraid of surprises and ruining their forecasts and their budgets. So yeah, they want to help them optimize their spend.
And in the theory being that if you've optimized your spend and they get great results, ultimately they will spend more because it provides more value.
Absolutely. I don't want to speak for Microsoft, of course.
Sure.
But it seems to me they're not into the churn thing, with just short-term gain and then let them go. There'll be other customers coming along.
Right.
I don't think that's the way the cloud works. There's already enough fear, loathing, and nervousness among people. Anyway, it seems to me that these cloud vendors want to build and maintain as much goodwill and trust as they can.
Now, is there not an equivalent mechanism on the AWS side too?
Yeah, there is. They have subscription guidance. I'm trying to think if they have a machine learning engine for spend like Azure does. I'm pretty sure that they do, but Everything after the but is BS, though, right?
Right.
But it seems to me that just from a general, having experienced the technology over the last few years so deeply, there's less of a hand-holding in Amazon Web Services. It's like the tools are there, and you're almost left to just find them and you learn how to use them yourself. And that may speak in part to the open source ethos that's always historically been part of AWS. And to draw a stereotype, you think of a stereotypical open source person as normally a go-getter. They want to find knowledge themselves. They want to come to their own conclusions and do it their way. So maybe that informs a little bit the fact that the AWS Management Console is, well, it from a UX standpoint, I'm not that big of a fan, to be honest. And from an education standpoint, their documentation's quite good, but it tends to be a little bit dry and very technical.
Yeah, I've always gotten the sense the way AWS approaches this is much more with a third-party set of tools. So there's more, you've got to find somebody out there who's going to do optimization for you or provide a service like that. That they seem to be sticking much more on the infrastructure side than getting into more of the advanced platform stuff.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that, because that's another huge difference between AWS and Azure. I like to describe much of AWS as an open bazaar.
Right.
The fact that you can bid like you would for an airline ticket with Priceline.com, you can bid on compute power using their spot instance mechanism. And like you said, oftentimes you'll go to solve a problem in AWS, hybrid cloud would be a chief example. Mm-hmm. And instead of seeing inbox solutions, you'll see pointers to third-party partners.
Right.
Microsoft, of course, uses third-party partners, but I think they're much more seamlessly integrated in the Azure APIs and experience.
Yeah, now I'm wondering if the big third-party space for Microsoft ultimately would be Azure Stack, that we're going to see these middle-sized specialist providers in narrow markets or with specific skills that are just going to run Azure Stack on your behalf and provide an exceptional level of support or a specialized set of services.
Hmm. That's a very interesting thought. I wonder how that would work license-wise, because what little I know of Azure Stack thus far is it's Azure in a box, but it's literally a black box to you as a customer. I guess you're not even allowed to crack it open and inspect the hardware without putting your support agreement in jeopardy. But yeah, I can see where the independent software vendor space could fit in there to Azure Stack if they could make it work contractually with Microsoft.
Yeah, I think it's more of a configuration, attention, market space, mm-hmm. data governance model, right? Mm-hmm. They certainly, the shows we've done around Azure Stack have also the same thing. Like, this hardware is literally an extension of Azure. Mm-hmm. We're going to manage it. We're going to update it, but it lives in its own version of the portal, essentially. But I do appreciate the idea that you could have a set of specialists focused on a vertical or focused in a particular market that could provide real value on top of that for folks who really want a platform or a software as a service play, but with these mm-hmm. constraints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. Boy, just think of all the companies that have made their dime doing just that historically, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. adding value to base Microsoft services. And of course, that's the case with Amazon. Think of how many businesses use the S3, the simple storage service,
right,
as their back end.
Yeah, and just wrap it up, because the average company doesn't want to deal with the complexities of S3, mm-hmm. but if they can deal with this stores this stuff for you and it works everywhere, that's very mm-hmm. compelling. The story I had offline, and you know me, is heavily involved with humanitarian toolboxes.
Yeah.
What if we took a set of Azure Stack, a mini chunk of cloud, and we put it on a hospital ship? And then we were able to, during a crisis, put that ship right offshore in a place that typically has relatively low bandwidth and performance, and mm-hmm. the cloud's a long way away. And I'm immediately thinking about places like Western Africa mm-hmm. during the Ebola crisis. But because it's in the common infrastructure of Azure, we don't have to build custom software for it. It runs on regular cloud. Mm-hmm. You just have it really fast and very optimized during that crisis. And then as the crisis winds down, you can shift it off to regular Azure again. People still have access to it, but instead of the 20 millisecond ping times, they're back to 200 millisecond ping mm-hmm. times. So mm-hmm. I like this idea of dynamically allocatable cloud from a geo perspective.
Yeah, that's a really interesting and thought-provoking use case. And it reminds me of that goal, which it looks like Microsoft is realizing. One set of APIs to rule them all.
Sure.
That if something works in Azure Cloud, for the most part, it should work the same way, or maybe not for the most part, maybe exactly it'll run in place in Azure Stack.
Well, I'm finding more and more that the issue here is keeping the code running, right? That the whole point of the cloud is hardware is plumbing now.
Yeah.
And then, you know, at IaaS level, VM is plumbing. Platform gets more complex, right? Obviously, there's more value propositions and so forth, and far more lock-in. If you're just shopping for VMs, well, then AWS versus Azure, it's basically a cost decision. Or is there more to it than that at the VM level?
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's another whole can of worms, isn't it? The platform as a service versus infrastructure as a service conversation.
Sure.
I'm a huge proponent that unless there's a compelling reason to go with virtual machines, examine PaaS. I mean, you're giving up a little bit of the control, but look what you're getting in return. You're getting a pretty much fully hosted environment that's capable of auto-scaling, and it's just so much more agile. You don't have to patch the underlying VMs.
How much value are you providing as an IT guy if you're responsible for patching? Like, it just seems like that's a known service you should just be able to pay for now.
Yeah, right, exactly. The future of the IT professional. Will the IT professionals, there's a certain term I'm searching for, their viability, I think, is the term I want. And where does that fit into cloud computing and the IaaS versus PaaS scenario? Yeah, that's absolutely right. There's no doubt that some of these people, their jobs may be in jeopardy because there's nothing really for them to do if their businesses use line of business apps under PaaS as opposed to IaaS.
Tim, give me 1 second here to pay the bill and let's dive back into that. Have you looked at Google Cloud Platform yet? GCP supports Windows Server 2008, 2012, 2016, as well as SQL Server 2012, 2014, 2016 Standard, Web, and Enterprise editions. Your developers can build their ASP.NET applications directly on Google Cloud Platform with Visual Studio integration. Prefer containers? Google Cloud Platform is the original Kubernetes container environment. And if you need help, GCP has a great set of partners, including Capgemini, Neudesic, and Magenic to help you get your workloads across. Go to gcp.runasradio.com to get your free trial today. And you're listening to Run As Radio. Richard Campbell here talking to Tim Warner, and we're talking about IT people losing their jobs. And I don't know if I buy it. You know, if you really wanted to spin screwdrivers, if that's what you loved as an IT guy, racking and stacking servers, there are fewer and fewer jobs in that space. There's no two ways about it. Go work for a cloud provider. Although really, you're going to work for the hardware manufacturer that provides the cloud provider, the Dells and the HPs of the world. And the same thing, if you love patching operating systems, it's kind of an out-of-date concept. I think there's plenty of work to do for people who are IT-minded when you talk about maintaining service-level agreements, validating backup and restore strategies, operating the infrastructure of the cloud on behalf of your customer or, you know, your employer. That's the seems to be the big growth role right now. Cloud doesn't just happen. Somebody's got to run it.
Yeah. And I'm not sure how many businesses, once you get up to medium, large enterprises, are going to be able to feasibly go completely in the cloud. So more commonly, we're going to be looking at a hybrid situation. And so, yeah, I guess there's still an opportunity for the IT professional to get his or her hands dirty with a screwdriver. In fact, being a curmudgeon, it makes me a little sad to think that people coming into IT nowadays may not have had that experience. They're thinking only in terms of virtualized processor, memory, storage, and network, you know?
Well, and all the more reason, you know, the reality, I look at the automobile industry as a great measure of the computing industry. Cars got so much more reliable when they basically were not maintainable by anybody other than an expert, that it was a specialty skill. The shade tree mechanic is largely working on older cars these days. And the same thing with computers. I still build my own personal PCs. I happen to find that enjoyable, right? I am a shade tree mechanic, but I'll tell you, as good as I am at it, they are simply not as reliable as off-the-shelf, professionally manufactured machines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Another thing that comes to mind, my suggestion for the IT pros who's concerned about having their skills rendered obsolete, is to broaden and deepen. I mean, even if the business is considering going to a PaaS, an Elastic Beanstalk, or an Azure App Service regime,
yep,
with the database running, again, in a hosted cloud environment and storage accounts, there's a lot in there that it seems to me the developers either don't know about, don't care about, don't want to deal with. And a lot of that plumbing detail is still relevant. Think of the network stuff, the auto-scaling, think of load balancing, geo-distribution.
Yep.
The developer probably doesn't give a hang about that other than they just want the pieces to be in place so their application runs.
Smart developers, and this is maybe a DevOps conversation more than anything, are aware that scaling doesn't just happen.
Yeah.
That it is partly software as well as infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But if you're still dealing with an organization where the devs are chucking code across the wall and saying, hey, IT guy, scale this for me.
Yeah.
There are solutions out there up to some limits. Mm-hmm. You know, there are ways to make that happen. I just hope we're past that. You know, the containerization strategies mm-hmm. that are out there today mm-hmm. are really about inherent designs that are more scalable. That yep. I'm gonna put your code in a can that is architecturally the same, whether it's running on the dev machine, the QA machine, or the operations machines. It's just a question of scale after that. How many of these do I need to run and how do I balance between them?
Yeah, exactly. You took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to mention the C word, containers. Mm-hmm. The developers may need to test their app against several different versions of MySQL, for instance. And it seems to me that the IT pro can be very helpful in helping get, you know, a container orchestration cluster and make it available for their devs to just spin up and destroy these containers as they need them.
Yeah, it's much easier than it was. We tried to do that with VMs for a while, and it was just uh-huh. so much harder. I look at containers from an IT perspective as VMs with configuration as code in mind from right. the beginning.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you have to build them from a script. There is no other mm-hmm. way, and they mm-hmm. tend to be created and destroyed very freely because they don't have the operating system embedded in them.
There it is.
So you just sort of eliminate those problems. But other than that, it's a VM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That whole concept of orchestration, administrative automation, other things that I strongly suggest IT pros who are concerned about their job security dive into, even though likely they're doing it kicking and screaming. The notion of infrastructure as code and looking at servers and services as herds rather than as individual pets.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is real stuff now, and it's so much easier to do nowadays with public cloud services as opposed to the days when if you wanted to expand your web server array, you may have to request honest-to-goodness rack servers.
Yeah, new machines. It was a weeks and weeks to scale yeah. the site
yeah.
versus minutes.
I know. You know,
it's just a knob on Azure or mm-hmm. on AWS for that matter. They both got that knob. Just scale it up.
That's it. With a line of PowerShell or a click of the mouse, you can increase or decrease your CPU, your processing, your network bandwidth. You don't even need a screwdriver.
mm-hmm. Yeah. And it again, changes that. Thank you so much. But I like the sort of cycle we've come through here in this conversation, Tim. I think the pressure starts with us looking at budgets for replacing hardwares on those mm-hmm. 3, 4, 5 year cycles
yep.
and the contracts for the colos and saying, you know, does it make sense to look at these other options? And it's certainly you're not just going to go one or the other. And I, you know, talk about IT job security. Going hybrid cloud
mm-hmm.
is an increase in complexity.
Mm-hmm.
You've got what used to just be on-prem is now in two locations at a minimum, probably more, because you still get your on-prem stuff and now in the cloud. You know, that's not necessarily simple, even if it is cost-effective mm-hmm. and solves other certain problems like rapid elasticity.
Yeah. And, you know, we haven't mentioned disaster recovery yet, but boy, yeah. is that huge.
That seems to be the entry drug, I think, from an IT mm-hmm. perspective for cloud. It's mm-hmm. like just being able to maintain copies of your VMs off-prem automatically.
There you go. Exactly right. Historically, I'm sure you know this, that Microsoft has had a much stronger hybrid trajectory whereas AWS really hasn't so much. And at least my observation, their hybrid story, AWS is relying upon third-party partners. But just like you said, the idea of instead of maintaining a secondary data center in maybe another one of your corporate campuses or a co-located facility, to use the cloud as a disaster recovery site, not only as a place to target your backup corpus, but actually to have your servers and services replicated up there such that you can just do a push-button failover if some catastrophe happens on-premises.
I think that the biggest benefit I've experienced using the Azure backup model is you can actually test the recovery process.
Right.
And light up. Turn those instances on inside the cloud, isolated from the world,
yep,
while your production site's still running on-premise.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually know it works. You know, how many times have we dealt with this where companies aren't willing to really exercise their recovery strategies because they're afraid of disruption?
Oh boy, that's something that'll always put a chill when I'm teaching, like at a conference, mentioning how often do you test the integrity of your backups? How often do you do a test failover? That'll send a cold chill through many people in the room.
I'll tell you a story. I'm working with a company in Europe, in the Netherlands. Two data centers in the Netherlands. One's the primary, one's the backup site. I'm like, well, how many times have you failed over to it? Never.
Yeah.
So you don't know if it works. Oh, no, it definitely works. Like, super confident that everything's fine. So I'm pushing them to, we should actually do a failover.
Yeah.
And in the window of those months working together where we're trying to plan a failover, there was a fire in the backup data center.
Wow.
Really unusual.
Yeah.
And here's the more important part. The shutdown of the backup data center due to the fire took down the production site. It wasn't actually a backup data center after all. It had a primary dependency. So that people just didn't understand because we'd never done it. Mm-hmm. We never tried to operate with one or the other locale not running. So they actually had this two data center dependency.
Yeah.
So it was just one of those moments where it's like, I remember when that was just a backup site that you didn't have any problems failing to. And now it's turns out it was actually a primary on something. And we need to know a lot more about what's going on.
That's a whoops. And that's what is called a resume generating event, I think, for one or more people.
It definitely spawned some conversation.
Yeah, because it's one thing to recognize the need for disaster recovery. The next step would be to actually get a solution in place. But the third step, often overlook, test the dadgum thing regularly to make sure it works.
Yeah, that you really can believe in it, that you know where it's at. And so often, you know, I think in conjunction with this conversation is the whole idea of, well, if they go all the cloud, I don't have a job. It's like, hey, maybe you'll free up enough cycles to actually test our disaster recovery solutions.
Mm-hmm.
No IT shop I've ever been in ever got to the bottom of their to-do list. ever.
Yeah, that's part of the process. If you're familiar with David Allen's Getting Things Done or GTD, it's assumed that you're going to have items on your to-do list. It's just that you review them regularly.
Yeah, and you're not, and the ones you're not getting to are not the ones that are crisis. You know, they can wait. The question is, what are the oldest ones waited for? Some stuff that's never been done, like testing a failover strategy, like that's just going to burn you eventually.
And not surprisingly, what a huge independent software vendor market that has for on-premises, hybrid, and or with the Amazon and Microsoft clouds. I think of Veeam, for instance, businesses that build solutions to ease disaster recovery, including failover and failback testing.
Absolutely. And it also begs the question, I don't know if you're running into any customers that are actually doing this, because I think lots talk about it, but they don't mean it.
Yeah.
Is being cloud service provider redundant, that I can run this on Azure or AWS and have no problems?
Yeah, absolutely. The concept of the walled garden I found in my work is something that, whether it's true or not, some businesses will just refuse to consider the cloud because they assume that they'll be basically trapped within that ecosystem with all these vendor-specific dependencies.
Yeah, some stuff is definitely common, but it's no different than buying a Veeam backup solution. You are, quote-unquote, trapped in the Veeam cycle now, too, right? You implement and learn how to use a product that is just as much lock-in as the cloud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think at least I know Microsoft has their Azure Site Recovery or ASR. Yeah. And one of the common use cases there is migrating resources from other clouds like mm-hmm. AWS into Azure, either a replicated failover relationship or if you're just moving from one vendor to another.
Yeah. And at the same time, it's presented as a disaster recovery solution. Mm-hmm. So you're backing up your Hyper-V on-prem stuff or you're backing up your VMs from AWS. And then if you need to move over, you can. Mm-hmm. And certainly my experience has been when you could pick one of those VMs that's just a backup right now and light it as an instance and just mm-hmm. tour around it and realize how quickly it comes to life.
Yeah.
And that you can do work on it and then kill it, mm-hmm. throw it away. Mm-hmm. It's no big deal. Like you have a level of confidence you just don't have in a lot of other solutions.
No doubt. And that elasticity is a point that's worth repeating. It's not just a question of scaling a server or service out and up. The great beauty is, as you just said, when the peak is over, you can scale back. You can't right. do that on-prem. If you buy a new server, you're going to live with that for a little while.
No, you own it. Well, and I've lived through the dot-com boom. We provisioned for peak. You had to.
Right.
Which
right.
meant, you know, half the time, less than half your gear was in use.
That's right. Exactly. Yep.
And that's just not reality anymore. And but yeah, I love the ability that we were able to simply point at a VM that was a backup VM and say, let me buy a server mm-hmm. for 20 minutes while we restore onto it and work with it for a while. All right. Yeah, that absolutely worked. Okay, you can have it back now. Bye.
Yep. And that works with so many other resources. Like I have a customer who uses Azure SQL Database and they have it replicated to a secondary Azure region. Mm-hmm. And to save money because, well, it's money. They wondered if they could put the replicated copy at a lower pricing tier than the primary. And you can. So there's nice opportunities here for cost savings while still maintaining really nice high availability.
It's interesting. That's another value proposition for an IT person is to spend time understanding all these elements and then turn mm-hmm. those things down where they can be turned down. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It seems like the IT job is more fun than ever, Tim. Like there's so many interesting pieces to work with here and to feel... be really able to bring more value to the table for your employer.
I agree with that. It seems to me that the people I know in IT who are happiest are ones who embrace all of these toys to play with because they get a really big kick out of it. That's the case for us. Mm-hmm, and you're a mm-hmm. developer, so I guarantee you love puzzles. And what is IT but solving puzzles? It's wonderful.
Yep. They're all puzzles. How do we move these pieces around to actually get the results that we need? Every bit of it is. There just seems to be a lot more options on the IT side than ever was before. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somehow a half hour has vanished, Tim, and it's almost like I felt like we were doing the warm-up conversation about just talking about these different options. It is fun to think about the cloud from an IT perspective mm-hmm. and the value that it brings into the table.
Indeed.
What's next for you, sir? Am I going to see you in Vegas?
The next conference I'll be teaching at is Tech Mentor in Orlando in November. I was going to present at IT Dev Connections in San Francisco, which is in about a month. But I just, like you said, mm-hmm. Richard, I realized I'm doing too many conferences. I need to enforce some work-life balance here. So
a little more restriction. All right. I'm not sure I know what the heck that balance yeah. thing is, but I find my way through. But I appreciate you spending some time with us today, just talking about really, you know, the cloud's grown up. It's time to really look at it.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. And as always, great pleasure talking to you too, Richard. Thanks.
You bet. And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.